you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
Hi, I'm Jordan Harbour. Thank you for listening to the Twilight Histories. Today we have a creepy story that takes you to a very strange alternate universe that mixes World War I with the dark arts. Before we get started, we have an announcement. We have just launched our first Twilight Histories novel. It takes place during the gritty years of the fall of the Roman Empire. I'll tell you more about the novel at the end of the show, so keep your headphones on. For now, let's jump right into today's show, Lord of Heligoland, by Kevin Valbenesi.
When we think of the First World War, it's easy to snap to images of weary men in the trenches, or hellish landscapes of muck, craters, and barbed wire. To be sure, that did define the Great War, but there were a number of other fronts, from the windswept deserts of Arabia to the frigid waters of the North Sea. But you already know that. After all, that's why you're here. I see here that you're interested in the naval history of the First World War. I think we can accommodate you there. I also see that you listed a preference for not being present at any major battles. That's odd, but if it's a matter of personal safety, I can understand that. To that end, I did find something interesting for you. We have a timeline here where at least one major naval battle didn't occur. We're sending you to the North Sea in 1917, where you'll be placed on the HMS Calypso. In our timeline, the British were preparing an ambush on German naval forces in mid-November, but here, that won't be the case. If you'll step over to the staging area, you'll find a uniform and your equipment. Please get changed while I finish your orientation. Now then, as I said, the British were preparing to ambush German ships, but on November 16th, 1917, there was a massive disturbance. The HMS Calypso registered a loud booming in the direction of the Heligoland Bight, followed by an intense flash of light. The following day, the German ships were nowhere to be found, and there was a preponderance of debris floating not far from the island of Heligoland. You'll be accompanying a number of British Royal Marines as they attempt to make landfall on Heligoland and find out what happened. It should be an in-and-out affair, but hey, you'll be at sea, you'll get to visit an island, and, well, you'll look good in that uniform while you're at it. All right. If you step over to the platform here, we'll get you on your way. Oh, and I should mention before you go that while many sailors are prone to flights of fancy, on occasion, there is real strangeness out there on the high seas. You stand atop the HMS Calypso, the frigid November winds at your back, and the inky black waters of the North Sea stretching out before you under a steely sky. Your uniform does little to keep you warm, and so you pull a cloak around your shoulders in a vain attempt to fight back against the encroaching cold. You've been standing up here for the better part of an hour, and it's astonishing to you that you've lasted this long. Or anyone to really pay you any mind, the hardened sailors manning the Calypso might notice the green pallor to your skin and the way you rock back and forth as the ship presses on through rough waters. Were it not for the blues of the Royal Marines wrapped around you, it would be all too apparent that you are just in fact a tourist. Luckily, the crew don't pay you much mind. Why would they? The life of a seaman is hard, and the minutiae required to run a ship allow for little time to spare for the less than seaworthy. The engine must be fed, the deck kept immaculate, and the guns ready at the first sight of German steel on the horizon. Even though these men fancy themselves the mightiest force on the open seas, they must also toil under the constant threat of attack by the German U-boats. On more than one occasion, you've seen them scramble to the bow of the ship at the first hint of some strange shadow in the water. Often, it's a mere trick of the light, but better to be safe than sorry, given the circumstances. A razor-sharp wind cuts through you, nearly forcing you off your feet by the sheer iciness of the blast. You think to sprint for the interior of the ship, but your curiosity keeps you rooted in place. You're so desperate to finally see this Isle of Heligoland that you'll apparently suffer any evil, including frostbite. Someone marks your suffering, because you're surprised by a firm slap on the back, which itself nearly costs you your footing. You whinge and turn to scold the impudent wretch, and instead find yourself having to crane your neck as you look up the nostrils of one Sergeant Pike. He's a mountain of a man, his peak capped with fiery red hair. He looks like he just rolled out of bed, though you can't ever say you've seen him looking quite sharp before either.
What the devil are you doing out here? I just stepped out and I'm already frozen below my trousers.
You smell coffee and tobacco on the Scotsman's breath, and it causes you to recoil a bit. You pull your cloak tighter around your shoulders and gesture to the open water.
Just enjoying the scenery. You're a kind of curious bird, aren't you? Where did you say you were from again, Lance Corporal?
Canada. Hull, specifically.
Was that right? You're a frog, then?
Excuse me?
A frog? A Frenchie?
No. No. A long beat passes between the two of you, and then Pike bursts out in laughter. He claps you on the shoulder and shakes his head.
I didn't think so. You know, my gran always said that's why we took Canada from the French. Them dainty boys won't suffer a snuffle, let alone the snow.
You can't help but crack a smile, and that only makes Pike's grin even more absurd. The two of you walk to the port side of the ship and look out at the emptiness of the North Sea. Pike, for his part, looks totally at ease in little more than his trousers and a knit jumper. His gaze is broad, not particularly looking for anything on the horizon. Whereas when you really look out there, you're hunting for even the smallest pinprick on the horizon.
You know, if you stay out here waiting for something to crest the water, you're gonna drive yourself crazy. Come down to the mess hall with me, grab a bite to eat, have some tea or coffee or whatever it is you colonials like.
Tempting, but it's alright. I'm sure we're almost there anyway. You strain your eyes, hoping to see something in the distance, but still, you're left disappointed. Say, Pike, Sergeant, did you witness the explosion by any chance?
Not the whole thing, no. I heard the boom, spooked me to high heaven and made me drop out of me bunk. Next thing you know, I'm looking out the window, expecting to see a German destroyer blowing us out of the water. But it was just bright. I checked my pocket watch, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. But you'd think it was the middle of the day, it was so bright.
You see Pike's eyes almost glaze over in the act of recollection. The man's breath quickens, and he begins to sway ever so subtly. You grab Pike by the shoulder, steadying him, and that seems to break him out of his spell. Are you alright, Sergeant? Pike's expression is solemn. He nods, and then stretches out his arm, pointing to something in the distance.
We are here.
At some great distance from the ship, you see the faintest hint of a rocky mass breaching the horizon. But it's not the island that now saps away the warmth still held out in your core. No, it's the perfectly circular, gaping hole in the clouds above the island, which fills you with chills. Your mind races to many radical assumptions about the source of the explosion. And soon, curiosity overtakes all apprehension. Pike takes a deep breath and utters a singular command.
go and tell the captain.
You secure your gear within your pack, checking that your magazines, your bayonet, and your revolver are all secure. Slinging your pack over your shoulder, you join Pike and the other Marines at portside. There are about four of you, all told, and all are dressed in their finest blues, and armed to the teeth. Captain Herbert Lawrence Edwards greets you with a nod, and you salute back. He's a handsome man on the razor's edge of 40. Just charming enough to turn heads when at port, but seasoned enough to command the respect of the young men who comprise the crew of the Calypso. Turning away for a moment, he raises a pair of binoculars to his eyes and looks out at the island of Heligoland. You're much closer now, and the general contours of the island are plain to see. Shallow beaches quickly lead to sharp rock faces, not unlike the cliffs of Dover. There is one part of the island where a steady incline gives easy access to the plateau. Atop the plateau are the twisted remains of what was likely a German fortress. Metal and stone lay in heaps everywhere, much of the debris scattered around the visible side of the island. More concerning than anything else, however, are the floating corpses of German destroyers and U-boats sticking out of the water at every conceivable angle. Well, you boys are in for a bit of a row. This is as close as we can get without running afoul of something under the water. Captain Edwards hands off his binoculars to an aide and then turns to address you all directly. The orders are simple. You are to make landfall on Heligoland and ascertain the cause of the explosion. Should you find anyone alive, make every good effort to bring them back to the ship in good condition. I have translators prepared to interrogate any German survivors. Don't overlook anything. Collect what you can and return here within 4 hours. If you can't depart in good order by that time, fire off a flare and we will make the proper arrangements. That said, Captain Edwards departs from the interior of the ship, leaving you and your comrades to board a boat. Pike climbs in first, followed by a turban-wearing young man you've come to know as Corporal Arslan Khan, and a sun-kissed Australian Lance Corporal named Francis O'Donnell. You are the last in, helped out by Khan and Pike, and no sooner than you have 2 feet in the boat do the deckhands begin lowering you down to the choppy waters of the North Sea. It's a descent of about a minute, and when the boat finally touches water, you all seize your oars and begin to row. Navigating the water around Heligoland proves to be a miserable affair, not least because the waters beyond its debris-littered environs are rough, but because the wind too struggles against you, as if to forestall your arrival. There is no time for idle chat as you all commit your breath to the task of rowing like true Argonauts, pressing forward to penetrate the eerie veil around Heligoland. After some time of laboring under considerable strain, you finally hit a patch of calm water. The rowboat glides ahead, propelled by your forward momentum. As you look back, you remark upon how the waters seem divided by some unnatural, unseen force, being agitated on one side and tranquil on the other. Nobody else seems to notice something amiss, and you're quickly nudged and ordered to continue rowing. The way is winding, and the pace slow, though not by any mysterious resistance on the part of the water. Now, it's a matter of navigating the upended ships and the U-boats floating ominously about. There's nary a sign of any survivors, but that doesn't stop O'Donnell from checking his pistol quickly, just in case. As you pass by the wreckage of one German destroyer, you notice that the entire side of it seems to have crumpled inward, yet you can find no evidence of a direct blast from any shell, nor the traces of fire or soot or anything which might suggest the explosive force of conventional weapons. Likewise, you come across a U-boat that is compressed like a soda can, and sticking up out of the water like a watchtower. Does anybody see any jetties? Pike leans over the rowboat and looks about the water for any corpses floating around. But it's nothing but metal for miles. But you think they all hurried off before the explosion? And how exactly would they go? Their ships are here.
the Germans would hardly leave behind such valuable vessels.
Hey, but then where are they?
Pike looks incredulously at Khan.
Why don't you climb aboard one of the ships and check for yourself?
Everyone laughs, and no one volunteers. Pike shakes his head at Khan, and then, noticing that only half of you are rowing, O'Donnell interjects.
Not the mission, fellas. Let's just grab our oars, row, and get there as soon as we can.
There's an awkward silence, followed by the rhythmic rowing of oars as everyone returns to the task at hand. As you row, you look up at the perfect circle cut out of the clouds. The sun shines through, but the light seems hazy and soft. You don't stare long, worrying that your comrades will scold you, and so you look back down, taking the occasional glance at all the ruined vessels. You round the remains of one destroyer, and find yourselves cruising over the crumpled midsection of another. Again, it appears the ship is largely intact, in so much as it wasn't blown up, just hit, crumpled, and folded by some incredible concussive force. You wonder what Wunderwaffe the Germans of this timeline might have come up with. That anything remains at all is at least some solace. We are not worried about venturing into the midst of a nuclear wasteland. But still, what has such force in 1917 to decimate the flower of the German Navy in a manner even Churchill could never dream of? You'll get your answer soon enough, for you finally reach a small outcropping of rock within a small cove. You make landfall and guide the boat over to a small area of the beach wherein it can be concealed among the rubble. Taking stock, Pike charts a simple course up the main incline.
Okay, here's the plan. We're going up straight that way. We don't have time to scale the cliffs just on the off chance any Jerry survived. I don't think anyone survived what's happened, but still, we're not totally exposed going up that way. There's plenty of rubble to provide cover. Obviously, make sure to keep your weapons at the ready, just in case. Any questions?
Everyone shakes their head. You take those orders to heart, holstering your pistol and fixing your bayonet to the end of your rifle. Peering up at your route, you see that it is indeed replete with mounds of brick, mortar, and twisted metal. The bowels of the German fortifications. You certainly won't be exposed to enemy fire, but that's not the real danger here. You're worried about whatever ruined the island in the first place. As if on cue,
I hold on a second, mate. What if this place blows up again?
Ah, well, then we die, obviously. But better here than the trenches, wouldn't you say, O'Donnell?
Silence.
Good. Now, get going.
And so you do, beginning the steady ascent to the mystery at the heart of Heligoland.
Good God, what were the Germans doing?
Khan cranes his neck, his mouth agape as he looks up at the cliff-like walls of the German fortress. They might as well be the White Cliffs of Dover. Khan is so stunned that he fumbles with his rifle, earning a scolding from Pike.
Could you mind your weapon before one of us loses our head?
Sorry, Sergeant.
Khan straightens himself out, but you don't. You look at the impressive fortifications, slack-jawed. This is far beyond anything the Germans were up to in your timeline, showing a sophistication rivaling that of Germany's more infamous wartime. That the walls themselves are largely intact, as far as the eye can see, is also unsettling. What, you wonder, had they worked to contain? And how is it that the walls stand, while the iron leviathans lay crumpled and flattened in the waters surrounding the island? None of this makes sense, and it causes your stomach to twist itself into knots.
Does anyone see a way in?
Pike looks about, but no entrance reveals itself. If you had to hazard a guess, the front entrance is buried under a pile of rubble somewhere near where you are now.
All right, we are going to split up. Two go west, two go east. Keep going, eventually we'll find each other. Hopefully, in front of a door. O'Donnell, you're with Khan. Lance Corporal, you're with me.
You and Pike head west, marching at a steady pace, exploring any recesses in the walls. It's mostly just guard towers and the occasional aperture for what's left of the turrets. But definitely, no way in. The Germans, in their attempt to preserve and protect whatever they were working on, exercised the highest paranoia in the construction of the fortress. And it's possible that they only left a single entrance to the interior. As you round the walls, you can't help but look at the gaping hole in the sky and the strange haziness within. It's as if you're tracing out the circle on the ground. That thought is enough to make you dizzy. You stumble, if only mildly, prompting Pike to reach out and steady you with surprising speed. You nod to him in gratitude, and then have a look around. I don't think we're going to manage this on the captain's schedule. You're probably right. Pike surveys the situation, and deciding quickly, produces a flare gun from his pack. Alright then, let's go double time. We find the others, and then we signal the ship. I don't want to do it now and have Conn and O'Donnell get spooked when they see the flare. Picking up the pace, you hustle around the perimeter of the fortress, mindful not to snag yourself on the shrapnel and jagged rocks littering the area. You give the fort a wide berth, and in doing so, you can take in the scene from the sea from a new vantage point. It really does look like something rolled over the vessels, crushing them all with ease. You can even see the marked difference in the character of the sea beyond the limits of the vortex above and that within. For an instant, the ground feels less solid beneath your feet, and you nearly stumble again. But your sense returns to you, and you continue on until finally you link up with Conn and O'Donnell. You find them waving to you from atop a pile of rubble. Reaching your comrades, you're surprised to see a pair of large iron doors laying crumpled at either side of a gaping portal into the fortress. You try to peer through the darkness, but find only the vague suggestion of a light at the end of the tunnel. "Well, look at you boys," shouts Pike. O'Donnell takes a bow as he rushed to the very edge of the doorway. "Any sign of the Jerrys?"
"Oh, I haven't heard a peep."
Pike raises his flare gun and fires into the interior of the fortress, lighting up a long corridor with several entrances to vaults and chambers on either side. Reloading, Pike fires into the sky, and then tosses the flare gun aside.
"We clear the interior as soon as we can, and then we rendezvous with the team they'll send once the captain sees our signal."
Pike shoulders his rifle and unholsters his pistol, aiming straight ahead as he plunges into the darkness.
"Keep your wits about you, boys. A loose brick's more likely to kill you than anything else at this point."
You, Conn, and O'Donnell follow Pike into the fortress. It's nothing spectacular inside, at least from what you can see. Shattered lamps hang from the low ceilings, and crates full of paperwork, rations, and even ammunition lay overturned, their contents littering the floor. You raise your pistol as you round the corner into what used to be a barracks, and it becomes readily apparent that you probably won't need a gun here. Rows and rows of bunks stand in perfect silence, the sheets scattered about, but without a single soul at rest in the room. Declaring that you've cleared the room, you rejoin the team.
"Anything?"
Everyone shakes their head no. "The Germans must have evacuated."
"And leave everything for us to pick over. They left their guns, their records, everything."
Conn is indignant. He grabs a crate of ammunition and dumps it on the floor.
"Do you have any idea what these rounds would mean to Ludendorff's men fighting on the continent?"
"If it's your life, or a box of bullets, then that's simple maths, Conn. Maybe they had to evacuate with great urgency."
"And how exactly did they evacuate?" "On the ships we passed. There wasn't a body in the water. Not so much as a jacket or a pair of trousers. If the Germans were here, then they never left."
You know where this is going, and even though you believe yourself, you find yourself shouting back at Conn. "So what? You think they just disappeared into thin air?" The question echoes out in the corridor, and it goes unanswered for so long that the flare finally dies out, leaving you all in the midst of utter darkness. O'Donnell fires off another flare, bouncing it off the walls until it lands some distance away near the exit. Unwilling to say anything, you all walk in silence, clearing rooms and advancing until finally you reach the next threshold into utter disbelief. You emerge into what used to be the heart of the fortress, where once stone and metal safeguarded the secrets of Kaiser Wilhelm's men. Now, there is a gaping crater, pockmarked with pools of murky water and piles of rubble. If anything remains after the devastation of this place, it's a single chamber, laying half ruined in the center of the crater.
Bloody hell, what are they doing here?
Pike steps down towards the edge of the crater and levels his rifle, scanning around for any sign of danger. As the rest of you look around, you discern a rough path you can take, moving from one pile of rubble to the next. There are patches of exposed mud, but you can't trust anything not currently holding up considerable weight, for an explosion with such dire effects would have carved an extremely deep crater, and if the crater had somehow flooded, despite being well above sea, then the bottom must be very far down indeed.
We'll try to stay on those piles of bricks. We go one at a time, because I don't trust you overfed scoundrels not to collapse them.
Pike goes first, leaping from the edge of the walkway and onto a pile of bricks some feet away. He lands and stumbles a bit, nearly dropping his rifle, but after steadying himself and feeling out the stones beneath his feet, he gives the okay. Khan goes next, waiting for Pike to leap onto the next pile and likewise check the foundations. All good. And so it continues on, with you following after Khan, tracing Pike's path until you all arrive at the half-ruined chamber. All of you, except for O'Donnell.
O'Donnell, come on, man, just go.
Now, mate, something's not right. Why are we going down there if this place is flooded? How's there this much water here when we are well above sea level?
We have to check, O'Donnell. We'll turn right around if there's nothing more to see, okay?
Pike is indignant. He grabs you by the collar and barks an order in your face.
Check the chamber. Let me know if there's anything to access the floors below.
You don't argue with the angry Scotsman. You shoulder your rifle and head into the chamber, immediately finding a stairwell which spirals down into the ground. Peering down into it, you can see that there is, in fact, light, and after stepping into it, you remark that it does go down quite a bit. There's definitely a way down. I've even got light down here.
There. You see, O'Donnell, we're fine. Nay, get over here before I come and grab you.
O'Donnell crosses himself and then slings his rifle over his shoulder. He gauges his jump, taking more care than he probably should. But after a good little while, he does make the first jump, landing with fairly little difficulty. Gaining a little confidence from the successful leap, O'Donnell prepares to repeat the feat. As you rejoin Pike and Khan, you catch something moving out of the corner of your eye. Something stirs under the water, releasing bubbles to the surface. You see a shadow form just under the surface, and you call out to O'Donnell,
"Wait!"
But it's too late. Water erupts skyward like a geyser, knocking O'Donnell off his feet. You all panic and raise your guns, just in time to see a massive red and white claw shoot out from the surging water and grab O'Donnell around the waist. As the water falls away, you see the mud-drenched form of a giant crustacean. The beast resembles a king crab with a sizable set of mandibles and a second pair of arms equipped with pincers. You all fire relentlessly at the beast, trying not to hit O'Donnell as he writhes in pain, screaming at the top of his lungs. Nothing seems to trouble the creature as your rounds ricochet off of its sturdy carapace. The beast scuttles about, throwing water here and there as it sights you and your comrades. Finally, it crushes O'Donnell between its pincers, killing him. But not satisfied with one meal, it charges at all of you. Pike orders a retreat to the interior of the chamber, where the beast can't quite reach you, thrusting its claws within in an attempt to snatch you up.
Enough!
Pike reaches into his pack and pulls out a grenade, lobbing it at the writhing maw of the beast. He doesn't quite hit his mark, with the grenade instead rolling under the beast as it presses against the walls of the chamber. A moment later, the grenade explodes, kicking the creature up, cracking the carapace beneath it, but definitely not killing it. The beast lashes out in pain, then retreats from the chamber, sinking back into the water, vanishing with the only prize it will claim today. Pike rushes to the edge of the chamber and fires a futile shot into the water, screaming like a berserker as he does.
You try that again, you bastard, then you see what you get.
He fires into the water again and again until finally you and Khan subdue him, just in time as well, as you notice several other spots where the water begins to churn in loose bubbles, suggesting that the beast which claimed O'Donnell's life is not the only horror submerged beneath the murky surface. You both drag Pike away, leading him down into the stairwell where his cries echo out like the lamentations of hell's countless souls. Pike slams his fist against the cold stone wall. He curses aloud, pacing the room with a mad look in his eyes. You try to console Pike while Khan watches the entrance to the room, rifle at the ready. The room you're in is an old research station, replete with charts, workbenches, and reams upon reams of documentation. Light is provided by a number of bulbs embedded in the ceiling, though the source of the power is unknown to you.
Now we know why there aren't any Germans left. Those things must have eaten them.
Pike throws up on the floor. You try to comfort him, but he pushes you back.
And now they're gonna get us too.
Maybe. Maybe not. I'm sure we can manage, but not until we know what we're dealing with here. You pick up a stack of papers and leaf through it, trying to parse the German technical notes. Whatever the Germans were up to here, there has to be information somewhere.
Has anyone considered that the monsters aren't the likely cause of the explosion?
Khan's point is well taken, but it makes no difference to the inconsolable Sergeant Pike.
I still can't wrap my mind around how it was that the place is flooded, or how it is that those things got here when we had to walk through a passageway that they couldn't possibly have passed.
Pike collects himself, finally. He props himself up against the wall, and after spitting up a bit more, steadies himself on his 2 feet. Checking his pistol, he takes the time to reload, doing so in a cold and mechanical fashion.
We get what we came here for, and then we'll go and settle the score with those abominations.
Well, we'd better hurry then. They might be missing us on the ship by now.
Everyone agrees. And after loading all weapons and checking on the meager supply of grenades held by Khan and Pike, you advance out into the corridor. Not unlike the above-ground facilities, this corridor is squat and relatively featureless. There are a number of side rooms, mostly filled with paperwork or the remains of chemists' workbenches. Thankfully, the continued presence of electricity gives you just enough light to permit a thorough search of every room. However, with Pike and Khan not being well-versed in the German language, it falls to you to try and decipher the copious amounts of notes, scribblings on chalkboards, and labels stuck to a number of crates. You can't really make sense of anything either, with the Germans having documented everything in uncharacteristically vague and inscrutable terms. From what you can glean from the documents, the Germans had uncovered something with promising energetic properties. However, they lacked the means to exploit it in a consistent manner, and at times found that its effects could not be reproduced under rigorous experimentation. You enter another room, this one appearing to be the quarters of the scientists, given the more luxurious accommodations, including shelves stocked with books and an ornately carved dining table, as well as a copious amount of bottled wine stashed in crates around the place. You all search about, with Khan eventually handing you a thick, leather-bound notebook with writing arranged in neat columns. At a glance, you identify that this is a personnel file, and that within, the superiors of this facility had logged a number of complaints by the staff, most notably, the guards. One guardsman, according to the notebook, had reported hearing strange rumblings during the late hours of the night, which the scientists dismissed as the echoes of geological activity, made more audible by their position here in the heart of the island. Another guardsman reported seeing a strange, shadowy figure entering the central vault, only for nobody to be found upon a thorough sweep of the room. You toss aside the notebook and wave Pike over. I don't think the Germans quite knew what they were dealing with either. If this was all caused by a weapon, they clearly haven't wrapped their heads around how it worked. And from the looks of it, the place was unstable to begin with. For all we know, they could have struck gas or something else. Not that you find anything else. There's a vault mentioned in these documents. I'm guessing if we're going to get any answers, we'll find them in there. Nothing about the big ugly crabs out there. No. And terrible as they were, I don't see them exploding like that and wrecking everything around them. They're just extra on top. You all regroup in the main corridor and elect to hurry along in search of this vault. You follow the wires supplying electricity, figuring that most of the energy required would be down there, and thus, following the main bundle, should take you to the entrance of the vault. Thankfully, your assertion is correct, and in no time, you find yourself in front of two heavily warped iron doors, both bowing as if smashed by some giant fist from within. Looking down, you notice that the floor is wet, and concerned that there may be flooding within, and thus a host of undersea abominations, you all arm yourselves and prepare to rush in. Pike levels his rifle and bayonet, while you and Khan take your pistols in hand and yank open the doors. Pike takes a deep breath and rushes in, and not a moment later, he gives the all clear. You step inside, your pistol held at the hip, and find a rather curious scene waiting for you. There's a central pond, shallow enough that you can see plainly that it is devoid of monstrosities. This pond is ringed with a thick, luminous moss, and at its center rests an aged, moldy chair which seems almost rooted to the stone at the bottom of the pond. Bloody hell, how's there even anything here? Pike stomps around the perimeter of the room, trying to make sense of it all. If this is the center of the explosion, shouldn't everything be, I don't know, gone? Pike runs his hand over a desk with a number of old cameras and notebooks resting on them. You notice a thin film of algae on the desk as Pike fiddles with things, disturbing the surface. Looking around, you notice that the algae covers everything else. The walls, most especially. It's like this place was underwater, Khan says as he lifts a beaker and finds it slippery and slimy to the touch. Now, here's a question, Khan continues. If the fort above was flooded after the explosion, and we're below ground now, at the source of the explosion. You and Pike nod, following the line of inquiry. And this place looks like it has been underwater for some time. Then, where's all the water now? Nobody has an answer. And so, you just continue looking around, trying not to twist your brain into a pretzel. All you can really do is busy your hands and hopefully your mind, because what happened down here defies any logical conclusion. What had the German researchers discovered down here? What could have catalyzed an explosion that only selectively destroyed a part of the island, leaving much of the rest untouched, save for the complete erasure of every soul? And what kind of impossible explosion would leave its immediate blast zone covered in algae, rather than totally incinerating it? What happened here? Turning, you look again at the singular chair at the center of the pond. You approach it, and with one hand clear away the mold and algae to reveal intricate, knotted woodworking, not unlike the Celtic crosses found across the British Isles. Curiously, you find the seatback carved in the manner of a bas-relief, depicting a bearded man straddling a rock surrounded by waves. This bearded man, with an expression of total serenity, raises what looks like an axe or a pitchfork up, as if to revel in a treasure freshly pulled from the depths of the sea. Following the curious contours of the image up to the crest rail, you find angular characters carved into something of a cartouche. Your brain throbs as your translator struggles to decode the message. You clear away more of the algae and wipe the cartouche with your sleeve, rendering its characters somewhat legible. Now you recognize them. These are Norse runes, but their meaning is alien to you. The best your translator can manage is a sequence of syllables. For se da woni. Come again? Asks Pike. He and Khan step over, glancing at the chair and the runes carved into it.
You can read that?
You nod.
Well, what does it say?
It's gibberish. I think. You rub the cartouche with your sleeve once more, and focusing in on it, you find that the same translation rings through your mind.
Forse da woni.
Forse da woni. Suddenly, you're all rocked by a violent rumbling from all directions. Beakers dance about on the tables, then fly to the floor and shatter. Then, you feel an incredible heat at your feet, and looking down, you find the water in the pond is boiling, sending you scrambling for the relative safety of the floor.
Ah, bloody hell, what now?
Pike hunkers down, keeping one hand raised above his head as if to forestall the imminent collapse of the ceiling. A few stones do fall from the ceiling, crashing onto the floor below. That's enough to force a run out of Pike. But before any of you can spring into action, there's a violent blast of light, followed by an incredible heat, as if that of the most hellish sauna, a searing humidity which penetrates to your very bones. You're knocked onto your back, and you writhe in pain as everything cooks. The pain is intense, but mercifully fleeting. Before too long, you're able to open your eyes, and despite the haziness of everything around you, you can see well enough to orient yourself. You see Pike and Khan likewise picking themselves up, but you also mark a third, roughly humanoid form standing next to a blur which you take to be the chair at the center of the pond. The hazy humanoid figure moves, startling you, causing you to fall back. You rub your eyes vigorously, trying to restore clear vision. And while you don't quite manage that, you can see well enough that where before you were three, here in the heart of Heligoland, now you are four. Rubbing your eyes again, you regain clear vision and find yourself seized with fear, completely paralyzed as you lay on your back, looking up at the stranger in your midst. He's a bearded man, well advanced in years, with an Olympian physique barely concealed by a glistening white tunic. He wears a helmet in distinctly medieval fashion, with two curious wing-like flares emerging from the crown on either side like a pair of horns. The man wields what looks like a double-bladed axe or a polearm with one hand, while gesturing at you and your comrades with the other. You notice that this man's eyes are white, without so much as a pupil or even an iris. Sight returns to Pike's eyes, causing him to howl in terror at the sight of this transplant from another realm, and raising his rifle, Pike unloads at the stranger. The shots hit the man's center mass, but they leave no mark on the man's torso, failing to even mar his tunic. In response, the stranger grasps his weapon in hand, and with a swing of it, dispatches Pike. But instead of finding the sergeant bisected on the floor, you witness him, his clothes, and everything else erupt into steam before dissipating quickly, leaving no trace of the Scotsman who stood there before. Khan, like Pike, panics and unloads his entire clip into the stranger, and for his troubles, is likewise transformed from solid matter into little more than a gaseous cloud. You want to run, but your muscles lock up, keeping you trapped on the floor as the stranger approaches you. Glancing over, you see your pistol laying within arm's reach on the ground, but you dare not go for it, preferring to save what little strength you have left for your futile struggle against the might of this otherworldly being. The brute stands over you and kneels down, snatching you up by the collar and heaving you close to his face. You can't help but look into the searing white of his eyes, and you feel your skin cooking as heat radiates off of him. You prepare for your imminent disintegration, but instead feel the burning breath of the stranger as he utters a solitary command.
Go and tell them all. Do not disturb my waters again.
And with that, you feel an intense surge around you as water flows over you. And then, as if suddenly trapped in the irresistible current of River Rapids, you're swept away, rushing at incredible speed, struggling to keep your head above water. Your body smashes against stone and more as the surge continues to carry you up and away from the heart of the island. In what feels like an instant, you're overwhelmed by the surge, causing you to struggle as water pours into your nostrils and your mouth. You convulse violently, struggling to break the surface of the water. But in time, your strength diminishes, and you go limp. No sooner than you've given up do you find yourself slammed down on solid rock. Water rushes away from you as you cough, struggling to breathe. You roll onto your side and spit up salt water. And gasping in air, your body jolts, and you spring to your feet, wobbling this way and that, until you finally find firm footing. As you orient yourself, your heart skips a beat, as you find yourself on the same outcropping of rocks where you first landed on Heligoland. You can even see the boat you stashed away, just as you left it. Utter disbelief causes you to drop to your knees, and you would stay there, unmoving, if it weren't for the jovial shouts and jeers you hear coming from behind you. Mustering enough strength, you shuffle back to see boatfuls of Royal Marines rowing towards you, likely in the midst of a rescue mission. All you can muster is to wave and try to dissuade them from landing, shooing them away. But most of their number simply wave back and smile. Your heart sinks as you know that they too will plunge into the heart of Heligoland and disturb its restless lord.
That was Lord of Heligoland by Kevin Valbanese. If you enjoyed this show, please consider supporting the Twilight Histories by becoming a patron. When you sign up through Patreon, you'll unlock over 50 shows only available to patrons. Plus, you'll get to hear a sneak preview of new shows before we launch them. Please go to twilighthistories.com and click through to Patreon. Before you go, we have an announcement. We have just launched our first Twilight Histories novel. That's right, we have a novel which you can own and put on your shelf. The story is by Josh Hutchins and the book is called Romano-Saxon War. Here's the concept. The Roman Empire is in collapse. Fear and chaos spread across Britannia as invaders ravage the coasts. The legions prepare to leave the island, but their swords are still sharp. A young time traveler arrives in Londinium. He was told this would be a fun adventure. He'd get to explore the pubs and sights of Londinium. He was given a job as a blacksmith's apprentice to make his adventure more authentic. But as the city descends into chaos, the young apprentice is swept up in events, turning his adventure into tragedy. Can the young apprentice steel his modern sensitivities to war? Will his shaky knowledge of modern weapons be of any help? Can he wield a sword lost to legend? Find out in The Romano-Saxon War by Josh Hutchins. You can find it on Amazon or on the website at twilighthistories.com. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening. Until next time. Take care.